coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello everybody and happy Tuesday night. Chris Jordan here coming at you live from North Austin. Hope everybody is doing okay. Welcome to the Realm family. Hope you're ready to get curious tonight. We're going to have some fun. The second part of the show this evening, our good friend Ryan Edwards will be joining us to talk about Sasquatch, a living legend. We will be talking about that, as well as the all-new Symposium of the Strange that is starting up in San Antonio there. The first one will feature King Gerhardt, Ryan Edwards himself, as well as Rod Nichols of Bear Bigfoot. We'll be talking about Bigfoot in Texas, all that kind of stuff. That is brought to you in association with Curious Events. Stay tuned for that, folks. There's going to be all kinds of awesome events coming up with that. We're trying to do like a monthly bi-monthly series out there. It's going to be fantastic. So stop on by and check that out. You can find it on Facebook. You can find it online. Just look up Symposium of the Strange and you will find it. Tickets are available on Eventbrite. So Ryan Edwards is our guest in the second segment. We have been doing tons and tons of pre-records. We have our whole pre-record schedule right here. I'm getting ready to hit the road for about a month of work, and you will be getting tons of new content. Next week, we will be having Maria Wheatley on to talk about dowsing, and specifically dowsing Stonehenge and ley lines, things like that. In the first part of this segment tonight, we were supposed to have Katie Elizabeth on to talk about champ research. We were going to be doing a whole crypto episode this evening. She apparently had some major connection issues, so she will not be able to be with us this evening, but I assure you we will still be going underwater, for it was announced this last week that the all new Manta from Northrop Grumman is out. This is the unmanned underwater drone. So we will be talking about that as well as other USO technology with our good friend Mike Turber. How you doing this evening, buddy?
I am doing good, sir. How's my mic sound? This is a different mic than I've used before.
So. Your mic sounds just like a mic.
All right. Mic sounds like a mic. Now mic on the mic. Jam on it.
Oh man. So yeah, it's been interesting. We on the show, you and I have been talking about USOs since pretty much Tic Tac launched. And since those videos launched, we have been talking about the fact that there were cases of USOs doing the same thing, underwater submerged objects. We have talked about cavitation technologies. We have talked about, which is basically the same concept that the Alcubierre White warp drive uses, just with gravity instead of water.
That and cavitation and all kinds of super cavitation effects for the USO to be able to traverse the water. Then you have transmedium craft that, as you remember, Sal Pius did the patent on that. So it could be pretty interesting. I definitely want to see some of that come to fruition. But as far as the USOs underwater, I think a few years back I had released some information to Daily Mail about a situation happened with a Los Angeles class submarine many years ago about an object that was moving underwater at about 550 or so miles an hour, or not, somewhere in that range. And then about a year later, it was confirmed. Lou Elizondo came out and released his variation of it. And then one of the people that were actually on the sub came out and talked about that last year. I can't remember the guy's name off the top of my head, but that was pretty cool. To have all that come out the way it did. But objects moving underwater at that speed, that's amazing. Absolutely amazing. So we'll see.
It you know, for years it has been the fact of hydrodynamic is aerodynamic. If you can make mm-hmm. something go fast underwater, if you can, and you know, sand's a wind tunnel, throw mm-hmm. something in a hydrodynamic chamber and you'll find out real quick if it will be able to fly. It's right. kind of interesting that Bernoulli's principle still fully mm-hmm. applies underwater.
Right. And water is 25 times more dense than air. So basically you just take your numbers, multiply times 25 and you can, or divide it by 25, depending on which direction you're going. And you can get a general idea of it. That's why they even do weightless testing and weightless training for astronauts. They do that in water because you can become neutrally buoyant, and these craft can obviously become neutrally buoyant when they're doing so. They expend no energy. So that's the advantage of doing that. That's why lighter than air aircraft, such as dirigibles or balloons, are very efficient platforms to place instruments on. Same thing happens when you think about putting a UUV underwater, like as in the case of the Manta, where you can have an object underwater and it can be neutrally buoyant and it can maintain on station for however long. These things can actually just sit underwater for whatever length of time is necessary, or they can be shipped to whatever location because they're modular in design and be put together real fast for the whatever specific task that's needed at hand. So it's going to be pretty interesting to see how these play out. But I think everybody's kind of fascinated by how fast something can go underwater.
Yes.
I think and the way you have to look at it is when you're pushing a wall of water in front of you, to move basically beyond that, it's just like we have that speed of sound, like the sound is a barrier and you're trying to push through it to get to calm air or whatever you want to call it. But as you push through, you're trying to do the same thing kind of underwater. And so to do that in using conventional type propulsion systems, you would create what's called cavitation or supercavitation. And that is essentially putting an air bubble around the object that you're in, and pushing the air bubble through the water is much easier than pushing the actual object through the water, because you're basically displacing a lot less at that point. You're moving the same amount of water, but it's a lot easier to do when you have the bubble effect, so to speak. That's also how they found out that some of the incidents that happened in the Bermuda Triangle were actually some of this methane gas, apparently, was coming up from the depths of the Gulf there and the Atlantic, and that created a neat environment that the ships could not apparently stay afloat in. And so that's kind of cool to see that. Actually, I think Mythbusters did a show on it where they actually had a boat and they just basically blew a lot of bubbles around the boat and the boat sank.
Well, yeah, because at that point, and that's something that I think most people, that you kind of have to wrap your head around physics-wise, mm-hmm. Mike, is that most people, whenever you're thinking of something in water, when you're thinking of something floating, you're thinking of A, dispersion for floating,
mm-hmm.
not a submersible.
Right.
And when you're talking dispersion for floating, you're talking a very large keel on a boat, mm-hmm. which means a lot of resistance on the top of water, which means, you know, you've got to have a deep cut to that keel. And even with that, like you said, you are pushing a wall of water in front of the boat before it splits around it, you mm-hmm. know. But when you're talking the shape of something like the Manta, which is very, let's just be clear. It's basically a stealth bomber underwater.
It's really cool.
Which is really cool. And that's the thing, though, is that the stealth bomber, and especially once you're underwater, you're dealing much more with, again, the Bernoulli's principle, as opposed to having to deal with the surface tension of water, things like that. So once you create cavitation in front of it, the same way we do with torpedoes to give them less resistance so they can move faster. We've been doing this since World War II.
Yeah. And the Russians had the speed record for the longest time on the starts with a K. I can't remember the name. It's like Kahula or something. I can't remember the name off the top of my head. But they have a torpedo that goes about 220 or so knots. I don't quote me on that because we flew this show together real quick and didn't have time to review notes, but I believe it's about that. And, you know, we didn't have anything like that for the longest time. And then, you know, finally over the last few years, some things were put together. The Manta is a program that's kind of related but unrelated to some of the other stuff that we'll probably talk about here in a minute. And as it regards to defensive technologies that we utilize as far as putting out, just like we have electronic warfare and electronic countermeasures and stuff like that, the same thing is going to happen when we place this object in the water. It is a very expensive object, and we want to protect it. And the other advantage to it is, since it's a UUV, it's going to have the ability to operate with other UUVs and link together into a basically a symbiotic system, so that each one will know what the other is doing. They could set it out for mapping programs. They could set it out for a rescue scenario where one could remain at station keeping and, you know, keep eyes on whatever's happening, and while the other ones do their task. So that's what's coming. That is a little bit delayed because communication underwater is not the same as communication through air, so that system is a little bit behind the time, so to speak. But stay tuned for that, where these systems will be similar to how we're going to have that. You know, we have the fifth and sixth generation aircraft that will have, you know, our EGAD fighter that will utilize drones that will act as a system, and so the same thing's going to happen with this type system by Northrop Grumman, I believe. A couple of the companies are going to be putting in some either competing technology or, you know, technology that's going to complement what they're doing. Because the you know, DARPA contracts go out left and right. So you've got Northrop Grumman, you've got Raytheon, you've got Lockheed Martin, and all these different companies that produce all these wonderful technologies. And sometimes one's really good at one thing and not as good at the other. So in this regard, you're going to look at Raytheon, which already has a underwater system that, as far as a link system that communicates very well, that system is going to be put into play. And then with the optics that it will have, you'll be able to get real-time eyes on whatever you're trying to do at depth. So that's going to be a pretty cool system. Well, but the Manta, go ahead.
Oh, no. I was going to say that's just it. Once you start integrating other systems into it, that's when you start getting something truly, truly special. And this is specifically that, by the way, you were totally right. VA-111 Shkval is the torpedo. And yes, 200 knots. Mike Turber for the win. you would be my trivia dude at the bar every day, dude.
Oh yeah, we still love Trivia Night at Wing It in Jacksonville, Florida.
Once you start marrying these technologies together, that's where the bonanza comes in, especially and like you were saying, the importance of a underwater drones have been what they have been trying to create for ages. And yes, the issue is you need to have them fully automated, because unless you're using long range, very low frequency, VLF. Unless you're using VLF antennas, things like that, which are huge, massive. A VLF antenna is typically like, you know, almost a quarter mile long.
They drag it behind the ship. And that's how a lot of that communication is done. And it's you know, you have the ultra low frequency signals that go out, and you cannot put a lot of information inside that signal, because it's not made to carry a lot of data. But you can say, you know, World War III has started. Please get to your station and start launching at will. Keep in mind, you know, the entirety of our submarine fleet, every single submarine the United States has, is nuclear powered. We have no diesel power. We have no battery power. all our ships are nuclear powered. And as such, they can sit on the bottom if they want for 6 months at a time, not and not surface and be just fine. So a lot of times that's actually built into some of the what the mission may call for, is that they may sit on station in some place and wait for orders to do whatever. This may or may not be happening right now. We may have submarines on station off the coast of China and right around that island there. I think they call it Taiwan. That may be happening, may not be happening. Who knows? Right. And that level of threat, keep in mind, one submarine is effectively more powerful than any country on Earth, other than obviously the United States, China, and Russia. So when you have one submarine that can dominate and be that powerful, then equipped with all of the cool advances that are happening now, like super fast torpedoes, obviously we have something now to match, you know, what the Soviets have or Russia has. And then you're looking at the advanced technology the Manta brings, whereas you can, by modular design, have a platform that can be adapted to do whatever you needed to do in the location you needed to do. And a lot of times that's going to be ISR. It's going to be surveillance. It may be search and rescue. It could be quite a few things.
Maybe taking out a pipeline. All kinds of things.
That's been known to happen, or delay like a little listening device next to a cable that happens to be laying in the bottom of the ocean.
Just lay an induction element right next to a cable line, a
cable that we probably laid.
but that's just it. Right now there has been huge announcement, and I said it whenever New Year happened. People asked me my predictions for the year, and I was like, you can be guaranteed to see some brazen things out of China this year. It is the year of the dragon. That is huge, especially when you're talking military. One of the things that they've been talking about is their scientists closing in on laser propulsion for ultra silent submarines. And the idea of as much thrust as a commercial jet engine using optical fibers that coat the submarine. So really interesting when you're talking about the speed of something underwater and the approach speed of something underwater.
Yeah, and keep in mind, they have the Chinese have an amazing submarine fleet. It's probably not as advanced as ours, but if you actually search up the secret submarine base in China, you'll see that, you know, we track a submarine seemingly going straight into this underwater wall and goes right into its undersea hidden base, which is kind of cool to see. The public was, I think, made aware of it about 2 years ago or so. But yeah, if you look that up, you might want to pull that one on your screen if you're doing this with visual stuff. But it'd be, I guess you would search China secret sub base, and you'll see a satellite image of a submarine going into what appears to be a wall. So the Chinese are ahead in some areas. And when they talk about the advanced propulsion and stuff like this, especially when you're talking about, superheating, seawater or what have you. And then if you go back to like the Tom Clancy years with the Hunt for Red October, when you talk about the magneto drive and stuff like that, that was actual real technology that they were talking about. Tom Clancy had unbelievable access to certain information and what have you.
He had Steve Peasnik.
Oh yeah.
Steve Peasnik was one of his advisors, and Steve Peasnik was hugely involved in the world of intelligentsia, things like that. He was advisor to numerous presidents, all kinds of things.
Yep. And he was invited to actually go to several locations and, given some information that was probably a little bit more advanced than he was probably supposed to be told, but At the same time, it made that movie work. The movie Hunt for Red October is one of my favorite movies of all time, and it's just
great film.
It is a great film, and the technology that they were talking about is very real. So if you advance that even further to what we're looking at now with advanced laser technology, superheating, when you superheat water, it expands. Water doesn't, you can't compress it, but you can expand it. So you have a flow that basically the only hindrance to the system is controlling the actual flow of the water using Venturi principle, Bernoulli principle, which you mentioned earlier. And these principles are very easy to understand when you think about it. If you put your finger over a hose and you pinch it down, that's Venturi, and you're creating a back pressure, and that creates more pressure coming out. Same thing with rocket nozzles and things like that. But when you're talking about underwater, propelling a submarine or what have you, at 25 times more dense than air, then you're dealing with cavitation issues. You're dealing with quite a few things. So hopefully that technology will be overcome. And hopefully we do it before the Chinese do. I haven't seen too much on that front, but Salpeus's patent comes through and everything is actually put together, then we won't have to worry about any of that, because the transmedium craft would be pretty cool to have. And I don't think anybody else would have that.
Well, and I've got a video up right now, Mike, out of MSN, or Interesting Engineering, actually, about a new sub that can pull like 180 degree turns in water at full speed. When you're talking about that kind of maneuver, and that isn't even like DARPA funded. If that was DARPA funded or deep research, like Manta, you wouldn't be seeing it in an Interesting Engineering video. All right. This is utterly a privatized company. However, when you start looking at just advances like that, that are out on the market out there, where the average constructor can get a hold of them, that makes things on a different level.
It does. And even when you can think of somewhat simple technologies like piezo, which you and I both know, piezo electronic communications, and as far as sounds tweeters make and stuff like this, a piezo induction coil placed in the water can create very instantaneous effects as far as propulsion is concerned with an object moving through the water. And if you need it to immediately go to the right, turn that thing on and it's immediately going to go to the right. But you obviously don't want to have people on board when that occurs, because they'll jellyfy them. That technology is similar in some of the technology that they wanted to have for aircraft, and like the F-16 HIMAT, which was a plane that could do, G-turns that would obviously incapacitate a pilot. But that's where the drones come in, and that's where I think a lot of our technology is going to go towards unmanned craft. And as far as the Navy is concerned and the Air Force is concerned, getting all these systems to where they can talk to each other and operate as one nice weapon system, that's going to be the step that's going to separate the big boys from the other ones. So it's good to have toys, but China has not gotten around to linking their systems together where they operate very uniformly. We have done a very good job. We're not at a supreme level yet, but we are way ahead of anyone else in that regard. So that's key there.
Yeah, but cross platform, and technically, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. I know from branch to branch, it's almost blind. Whenever it comes to like, oh, these are the tablets we're using. Oh, these are the tablets we're using. Like, for the same thing, they all use different crap. They all use different batteries in the field. It's crazy. It's crazy.
Yeah, there's still a lot of that goes on. But when it comes to the overall battlefield and the theater communications and all that, they have gotten together.
There are very specific systems that are used for cross-platform communication. And every platform going out in the field has to be able to utilize those.
And all right. It's like the Link 16.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, like the links and scene system. And yeah. then you have certain mission critical type systems that say a Patriot missile battery system is set to communicate with, say, the Navy standard on Aegis cruisers as far as tracking and multiple tracking of using the phased array radar, like the Spy One radar and so forth. So when you're looking at that, then that's one category where the Air Force would have, say, a different type system, but the similar synergies would work together and it would be the same. But the Air Force has its own system as far as handling its type system, but the Patriot missile system is pretty much a, you know, it's like some of our systems that we build it so it can operate on its own and it doesn't need that much outside resources to operate. And that's where, you know, a lot of the funding that goes into, you know, the DARPA projects and stuff like that is to get systems that can stand on their own. And when a company like Northrop Grumman or Raytheon or Lockheed or whoever produces these systems, they generally come out of the box ready to rock and roll as its own system. And that's kind of a key thing. It does make things more expensive because you're not integrating something into an already existing modular system, which is where the Manta comes in. The Manta kind of, you know, is a step in that direction where you can modularize things and have like an Air Force version can plug something in or, you know, whatever you need that UUV to operate as. Whether it be an ISR platform, whether it be a search and rescue platform or what have you, then that's kind of cool. But, yeah.
Well, and, you know, the video from Northrop Grumman was actively just showing things like, how would it get powered? Would it be solar powered? You know, things like that. And
does it discuss how it moves through the water? They discuss some of it.
They don't go into details, but they show the way that it basically like a glider, the same way a glider does. It undulates through the water to create its own lift and propulsion with the lift by taking advantage of gravity and then coming back up and using that sinusoidal pattern to carry itself. And it's fascinating to me once again. The world of automation that this would need, this is far beyond fire and forget. This is fully pre-programmed mission because once again, there as of right now, at least within declassified world knowledge, there ain't no way you're contacting that thing unless it surfaces or comes up high enough for a tethered beacon, the same way a submarine does. Like a submarine has to make itself vulnerable to communicate with home.
It does to some degree. Now, there are some communication systems that don't require a lot of data throughput. It's not like the Air Force has the TDRS, which is your terminal data relay satellite system and stuff like that. And NASA uses it for deep space communications. And that's for high baud rate transmissions.
Sure.
You're not going to get high baud rate transmissions
through
through any medium underwater. Yeah. So, but there is, comms that you can go in there where you'll have something pre-programmed, like you said earlier, like it's a pre-programmed mission, but you just send it a 2-digit code or whatever okay, now you're doing this mission and it switches gears. So,
yeah. But, and once again, our nuclear subs, all submarines do have like VLF antennas, things like that. They've got huge whips that they can deploy. That's how they get their transmissions when they're like under Arctic sea ice and things like that. That can be transmitted and it's quite literally teletype. You know, you see them go over and rip the message off and it's like, here's our instructions. Because unless they surface or come up high enough to put a buoy up, they aren't hamming out to anybody. They aren't going to hit a radio frequency through half a mile of water.
And the weird thing is that encryption at that level becomes kind of a whole art in and of itself.
Yes.
If when you try to encrypt a message that you can't put a very high rate of data transfer in, then it becomes very interesting as to how they do that.
Substitution on it. And yeah, how do you have a, I mean, once again, that's why you have this thing automated and its instructions in there, because then it can't be hijacked unless it's captured. And you can have protocols for that, for self-destruct or deprecation, what have you. But yeah, you know, that's a fantastic point to bring up, Mike, is the fact that that communication line is so compressed and so small. It's basically Morse code.
Essentially. Yeah. I mean, you can get some more. I mean, they've advanced the system to a degree. Plus we have the largest sonar network in the world. So the United States is surrounded by an undersea fence. I'll reveal some technology that I believe is declassified. I don't really care at this point. But back in the day, one of the first things I was trained on was what's called MAD, which is magnetic anomaly detection. And in the Air Force, if the Air Force is tracking submarines, you would kind of wonder, isn't that a Navy job? Well, it kind of is. It's kind of everyone's job, because your biggest threat in the ocean right now and back then was submarines. That was the number one job that our military had, was tracking where the Russians were with their submarines, because that was the scariest thing on the planet. And it still is today. There really is nothing more scary than knowing that a platform that has ICBMs on board can be parked off your shore. We're not talking about launching a missile from Korea and you have, you know, 27 minutes or however many minutes. We're talking about, you know, 3 minutes, 5 minutes from these launches, from these submarines. So you have to know where they are. And magnetic anomaly detection is a platform that they went to. They used to take these buoys and drop them in the water, and there are sonar buoys. And of course, everybody has heard like a ship going around or a submarine, and they send out that ping sound, and you're waiting for that ping sound to go out and then bounce off of whatever object it is and then come back. And then the sonar operator reads that. And these sonar operators are very good at being able to determine what they're listening to, because it is more of it's an art to be able to determine that.
Yes.
So but when you're dropping these sonar buoys in the water, they're $100,000 a piece. The batteries, you know, only last for so long. And then they, after whatever time frame, they just literally just, you know, do whatever and drop to the bottom. And it's a waste. But if you could track an object as it moves to the Earth's magnetic field, then that gives you a whole nother level. And we got to that level pretty much before anybody else did. So, you know, the Earth's magnetic field is somewhat easy to look at on a day-to-day basis. And if an object moves through it, whether it's, especially if it's metallic, you can tell. And that's how we were able to track quite a few of the submarines that Russia thought was super silent. And they weren't as silent as they thought they were, because they could be tracked essentially through their magnetic signature as it moved through the water.
Well, and that's exactly how the passive radar systems that were being tested on the Nimitz and all that kind of stuff operate. Detecting perturbations in those known magnetic field patterns, things like that.
Similar to like how a phased array radar works, in that it's more of a passive system rather than actively peeing, which is basically you're telling everybody. It's like running around underwater with a hammer and a pan and banging the hammer against the pan and listening to what comes back. You're not only are you trying to find out what's out there, but you're certainly revealing who you are and where you're at. So if you could do it more on a more passive system, which is basically just monitoring as things move through a, electromagnetic, field, then that makes it real easy. You could even actually see a whale as it moved, through it, because it would create enough of a disturbance that you could track it. And planes could be tracked as well. And now that platform has been moved a little bit further up. Whereas they don't have to fly these modified C-130s and what have you around trying to with those MAD units. I don't know if you've ever seen a C-130 with its RC platform on it. But it looks like a C-130 with the Pinocchio nose. So that and the MAD would also run down the side of the aircraft as well. It's like an appendage that would stick out quite noticeably, and you could tell that the system was packed aboard that aircraft. And then they would fly a certain patterns, and you would know what they're doing. But now you can move that platform up into space. And you can track essentially what amounts to every object on the planet as it moves through air or water via satellite. So.
Well, and you know, it was shown many years ago that you can do the same thing with Wi-Fi signals. You can quite literally use Wi-Fi signals to map motion in homes, things like that. It became a huge security concern for a while because people did not realize that. You could absolutely do that.
Yeah. As you move around inside your own home and you got that Wi-Fi signal that broadcasts out about 300 feet, you become anything that's static, that's not moving, obviously doesn't have a redshift, blue shift or anything in its signal. But as the object moves around inside of a house, whether it's human, soft object or hard object, it's going to disrupt the Wi-Fi signal, and that can be determined. So if you have a system in the way the first systems that came out was the police started using it, where they would park a van on the street behind the house, and they would have another van on the street in front of the house, and anything that went between the two, they would generate their own signals, and they could tell if someone was moving in the house and where they were and stuff like this. Now that system, when it first came out, obviously had some privacy concerns and issues, had some search warrant issues, because it was not necessarily announced, that they were using it. It's a system that's been around for actually a while now. And, you can definitely track someone in the house, and you can do it with light too. I don't know if you saw the, you saw that where they can actually bounce light around corners, so to speak, and come back with an image and see around corners using photons. So that's very interesting.
And I mean, they can do the exact same thing using just a copper wire in your house for crying out loud.
That's true.
Like you're surrounded by an electromagnetic field. You have no idea, people.
It's just the sensors that, how tuned in they can get to determine what's around them. Your house is a giant metal detector if you really want to look at it with all the coppers going through it.
Yeah. So. Well, and I think if anything, Mike, that is probably the most useful part of this whole platform of the Manta to begin with is its use for stealth intelligence gathering. Being able to electronically eavesdrop on communications, things like that.
Yeah, and then that's the advantage the man is going to have, because it's not something it's basically stealth underwater. It's not going to be trackable by our enemies and what have you. And its number one application is going to be some sort of ISR platform, obviously. And that makes sense. That makes sense. Also, that's where the money's at too. So if you need to put money into a project, put it into ISR and you'll have, you'll have your money to you a lot quicker than some of the other projects. Maybe search and rescue would be a quick second. The man is made in such a way that it can move. I don't know if they mentioned it, the hydrostatic type way that moves the water flow over the surface. There's some other technology behind that, and that the ship can pull itself forward, down and up, much like an aircraft would have to, you have a low pressure, aircraft flies because it has a low pressure on the top of the wing and a more high pressure below it. You can't reverse that. So the aircraft has to always remain moving to be able to sustain lift, which keeps it flying, keeps it in the air, which is obviously what you want. But in the water, you don't have that limitation. So what it did was it opened up the opportunity to explore, pulling the ship forward. Instead of up, like aircraft up or down or what have you, And also utilizing that surface area to disrupt a laminar flow of water across the surface. And a surprising thing happened where they were able to determine that if you do it in a certain way, you would be able to gain some rather hefty speeds and do it quietly. So you don't have the cavitation effect nearly as much, which creates a lot of noise. I mean, imagine, you know, taking a mixer and running it through the water, making bubbles as you go through it, and you put your object inside it to go fast. It's loud. It's really loud, but this thing is super silent. So,
interesting. Yeah, basically using hydrophobic materials to begin with, but then also electrostatic fields, things like that, or hydrostatic fields to help move the water along the surface.
Yeah, and they even tested some of this on the advanced. If you look at the leading edge of the B-1, the bomber, you'll see that some of the technology that you would think is only to be utilized underwater is actually utilized on the leading edge of some aircraft. If you disrupt the airflow in a certain area and over the front part of a wing, you know, your first thought is it would create a situation that would cause the plane to stall. But it also creates a lower pressure air, so it gives you added lift and some other properties that we won't talk about. But it's some interesting byproducts that happen from it that you do want on the leading edge of your wings as you move forward towards an enemy.
it definitely helps with performance ratios and how fast you're able to turn, what your turn ratio is, all that kind of stuff. And once again, to see that China is talking about their new laser propulsion system for underwater use, as well as the drone that we were talking about earlier that can flip 180 degrees at full speed. Yeah. These technologies are coming a long way very, very fast.
Yeah, and some of the other effects that you would get out of that is as a craft launches another craft, you know, some of these UAVs are going to be launching, or some of these UUVs will be launching UAVs as they get closer to wherever their target is. So some of the technologies utilized on this propulsion and you know, having an object, you know, flip 180 degrees or whatever is also going to aid in dropping a 21 centimeter wide canister into the water and having some scissor winged UAV, you know, come out of it. So imagine a UUV carrying a torpedo like device and essentially launching that either from underwater or at surface. And having these UAV pop out of your canister as it gets towards the surface, and then it transmits back through the systems that are on board, say the Manta or what have you. The Manta's modular, so it obviously has that capability. And there's some other craft that have that capability as well. It's been around. I think the Ohio class submarine actually carries an additional submarine on board. To be utilized by SEAL team or be utilized for search and rescue or some other activities that it's designed for. So some of that technology has been pushed forward into the MANA, and hopefully some of the MANA technology will go over to that because, you know, that submarine is not as pretty as the Manta, I can tell you that.
Well, and it says the craft, in regards to the Manta, that the craft is designed with several payload bays of multiple sizes and types to enable a wide variety of naval mission sets, which I am sure the insertion of SEAL team is one of them. At least an intended one.
I think it would be an all wet platform. I don't know if they're going to incorporate something that would have a life sustaining apparatus. I mean,
they could have their rebreathers on underneath.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's where I was about to go with that. And you know, so you have that capability, but at the same time, you know, that craft is a lot larger than, you know, when you look at it.
It's big. It's big. Like the pictures here in the article literally show a couple people like standing on top of it. Like it is, it is the size of a pontoon boat easily.
Yep. It is small.
And, you know, I can easily see this, within a decade being a transmedium platform, being something that could be used Air Force and Navy wise, that could be, deployed from land, deployed from aircraft carrier, all that kind of stuff. So, be able to take on missions cross platform wise, and even be able to go from ocean over the air into inland sea, that kind of stuff.
I think the utilization of the forces as they get to work together. Now, keep in mind the Air Force actually has like an SRT team that's on board and on board the Ohio class submarines, and so a lot of people are, you know, not from, but if you actually did a search for Ohio class submarine and Air Force and then the drone, you would actually see that back in 2004, which is kind of an interesting year, that a lot of things happened 2004, 2005. That they were testing launching a ISR-type drone with Air Force personnel on a Navy vessel, which doesn't normally happen, but in the same area that maybe some other incident occurred back then. So that's a whole other show. So I know I'm giving you a whole lot of crazy crap, but yeah, if you did that search, you would come up with some interesting finds. But the thing about launching aircraft from a submerged submarine is definitely nothing new. But also launching it from another UUV that's autonomous is kind of that's very new. So I think that technology is going to be probably put to use pretty quick here in the Asiatic waters off the coast of China, pretty quick. So.
Well, and that's just it. You know, you don't have to have the platform itself leave the water. You can have it launch an airborne drone from under the water, same way we do rockets, other launch platforms, all that kind of good stuff. So,
And it's not as intimidating as, you know, or even noticeable as sending in like an Ohio class submarine, which is, you know, a large vessel into waters that would be considered a, probably an act of war on the other side. So they probably would frown on that. But this thing could get in and do its job and get out. And, I think that, you know, I think we need a lot more of autonomous type craft that can do that, and also missions that are not necessarily pilot dependent. So
sure,
that's where we're going.
Who was it? There was a person that just took. It was the congressman, I believe, who helped start the Air Force automated jet fighter program just took a ride in the first AI jet fighter, the first automated jet won a few years ago against a human dog fight, but this one is even more advanced than that. This was pretty incredible. And to see these things happening, you know, it's interesting that that the UN and still allows unmanned platform. They will not allow it. They haven't technically passed anything about robots yet, but they still allow drone, and as long as you call it a drone, it ain't an issue. You know, it's interesting. It's interesting and that is, of course, a big concern, Mike, is, you know, could the drone be programmed enough to be able to make the decision to stop if necessary, you know, to be able to call a halt to a mission if necessary, because again, it wouldn't be like a drone where there's a dude chilling in Nevada with a Mountain Dew.
Yeah. You know? Well, I think the decision-making process is not going to get into the psychological or psychoanalysis aspects of it. A drone's not going to sit there off station and wait until, you know, a certain parameter is met. The drone's going to go to its destination, and the AI on board is going to be utilized to make more accurate decisions as far as hitting your target and maybe waiting for your target to become distance from other people around it. So you see, only get collateral damage and stuff like that.
But what if it turns into my favorite submarine movie, Crimson Tide? And suddenly, like, last thing they heard was launch missiles, man. But the message was cut off halfway. So this thing has its pre-programmed mission, but halfway there, situations changed. How do you recall that at that point? You know, if it's on a pre-programmed course.
Yeah, there's an old system called failsafe. Mm. And failsafe is meaning if your bombers or your aircraft get past a certain point, there is the point of no return, and the mission has to go, you know, full on at that point. And there's, even if someone came on and said abort, abort, you know, mayday, mayday, you know, fly back, we're okay, this is this is a drill, blah blah blah, even if that came on, they were told to complete the mission because that could be, you know, whatever. But the thing about AI and the thing about autonomous drones is that most of our drones are not using AI. They're utilizing certain, you know, specific algorithms and tested machine information to make decisions. And it's a very specific criteria that something has to meet before a target is, you know, acquired, and then a target is, you know, taken out. And if it doesn't meet that criteria, then it's not going to have the option of thinking about it. It's a yes, no binary type, decision. We have a similar thing as far as, satellites, taking images. If the cloud covers over a certain amount, then we don't even take the picture. It's not even worth it. But we have LIDAR and other stuff that can see through. So those decisions are made, and those are autonomous as well. But the AI decision-making process is going to be kind of interesting when it is able to choose the target. That's going to be a transition that is going to bring back a lot of ethical, you know, questioning as to how that will be done. And we all remember RoboCop and stuff like that.
I guess that's my concern with some of the things that it may be used for, even if it's used for, now granted, whatever drone you're putting in there would to carry out said bombing mission, what have you, could totally be controlled by a normal means.
Right.
You know, so that person would have the option of abort, 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 you know, but if it's pulling its own mission as far as, you know, even going to take pictures of something, what have you, going to drop an electronic bug like we were talking about or anything like that.
It's like the old thing of fire and forget, you know, you fire your weapon. You don't want to sit there and have to like keep your laser on the target the whole time and stuff like that. Sure. So giving that capability of going out and doing its mission and coming back is obviously a thing where the pilot can concentrate on the other part of the mission and, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
But your point's valid, and that there's going to be a lot of interesting, hurdles that we have to overcome that they talk about. Some of these meetings that I haven't been to one in a while, but I remember got a long time ago going to a couple of these, and sitting in on some of the stuff where some of the decisions as far as scenarios that are going to be played out in future warfare, you know, like things that we hadn't thought about before. You know, what happens if we do have a system that utilizes a laser as opposed to a munition that can actually be controlled. You know, keep in mind, when we fire a 3,000 pound shell from a Navy ship 27 miles inland, we still have a little bit of control over that. Yeah. And if something happens in the interim, we can, you know, we can, you know, call that munition off. But something with a laser-based system, once you make that decision, you press that button, it's done. there's no coming back from that.
Exactly. And that's a lot of reason I just popped up from UT News, the fact that, you know, the U.S. Army Futures Command is located right here in Austin, Texas. They are embedded with the University of Texas, working with the next generation of engineers to figure these things out, to get ahead of the curve on this.
You are in a cool area.
It's pretty hip, Doug.
I love Austin. I've always loved it. And, you got to get out there and get some of those local guys on it. Cause every time I look at something, I see Austin, and especially the last couple of years, it's like, wow, man, Austin's really kicking ass.
We're in the middle of it, man. And there's so much tech going on here, and there's so much tech, and that's just it, Mike. You know, it's one of those.
Elon was investing in that area.
I tag you with articles all the time. I tag other researchers with articles all the time, because a lot of people, like, keeping up with these things is not their day to day. You know, and it's like, it is an obsession for me to keep up with these things. And the RSS feeds I follow, the things I see, it's out there, man. We have an amazing future ahead of us. So I want to thank you for always coming in and pinch hitting, buddy.
Hey, no problem. Anytime, I'm there for you, brother.
Well, before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to keep up with Mike Turber, where they can follow everything, where they can keep up with 5i5 News, all that kind of stuff, bud.
Sure. Probably the easiest thing to do would be to check YouTube or Twitter. That's going to be where most of the updated information, or just search for 5x5 News. You'll generally find that I'll have some stuff posted out and about. We're going to do a lot more on TikTok here pretty soon, if they don't actually ban it.
Yeah.
And we end up losing it. But yeah, TikTok has been a pretty cool platform, and I've been very pleased with the results. So I think I'm going to explore that a little bit more as well, and also on Facebook. So anywhere you find me, engage with me. If you got a question about any subject matter that we brought up, tonight was a wing it kind of show. We put it together pretty quick, but hopefully we came through for everybody. But if you have any questions on anything you've heard, by all means, contact me through DM on any of the platforms, and I'll be happy to answer away.
Absolutely. Mike, thanks so much as always, bud. Take care of yourself. I'll be in touch with links, all that kind of good stuff. All right.
All right, buddy. Sounds good. Thank you.
Man. Take care, bud. Always great catching up with Mike Turber. Just ahead of so much technology he is. And the stuff that's out there is amazing. Speaking of stuff that's out there, don't forget to stop on by and get your tickets for the upcoming Symposium of the Strange in San Antonio, everybody. That is coming up July 31st. You can find those tickets on Eventbrite. We'll have links up on the website. You can go by Curious Events. We have links there as well. Stay tuned through this quick break. We'll be right back with Ryan Edwards to talk about Sasquatch, a prehistory, as well as other cryptids and the importance of zoo in cryptozoology, right after this.
The Curious Realm Podcast is your source for the latest and greatest news and events in the world of the paranormal, esoteric, and forbidden knowledge. And there's no better way to spark the conversation than with items from the Curious Realm store. Choose from fan favorites like hoodies, mouse pads, coffee mugs, and more. Buy books and items from your favorite Curious Realm guests. Get your hands on the latest gear for paranormal investigations and experiments we discuss on the show. Open your web browser and stop on by the Curious Realm store at curiousrealm.com/store to buy the latest Curious Realm wear and out-of-this-world gifts for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is curiousrealm.com
www.cavitationfm.com/store. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick break. Thank you so much to our previous guest, Katie Elizabeth. We had a great time chatting with her about aquatic cryptids, CHAMP, other cryptids in North America. Our guest in this section is Ryan Edwards. We'll be talking with Ryan about his new book, Sasquatch, A Prehistory of a Living Legend. We just had him on for a short segment at the Falk Monster Festival. Also, thank you so much to all of our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. They're your source for amazing CBD products, folks. Stop on by and check them out. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to go to. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more and get two, count them, two free edibles on the way out the door. In this segment, we will be talking with Ryan about cryptids, and not only cryptids, but cryptid accounts across North America. Welcome back to the show, Ryan. How you doing, bud?
A pleasure to be here, like always, Chris.
Absolutely, man. You are one of my favorite researchers for the fact that you and others like you are quite literally the future of these fields. You are getting ready. You're on the cusp of your third book. Sasquatch, A Living Prehistory, is quite literally your second book. So, amazing that you are just prolifically putting out material and putting out research. Your new book that you're getting ready to release actually deals a lot with North American apes and quite a bit of the odd sightings that are out there. Let's start getting into some of these, Ryan.
Yes, of course. Like, really, how I say it with me being the next generation of cryptozoology, I'm really on the forefront of great people, like people like Lauren Coleman, Mark Hall, John Binderdagle, all these researchers that come before me. And I'm looking into a lot of their reports, and in recent years, especially with cryptozoology, we've found kind of a more variation with Sasquatch. Like, you've probably seen it, the whole type chart of, like, Sasquatch, type 1, yeah. Type 2s, type 3s. And with me, I'm like, well, if it's a simian, if it's a primate, there has to be some variation, but maybe not subspecies or a whole other species of Sasquatch. So, like, one of my big interests within cryptozoology is, like, other unknown apes. For instance, here in North America, we have stories of the devil monkey, almost giant baboon-like animals seen here in Texas, parts of Oklahoma, parts of Alabama, along the whole Appalachian Trail. Then in recent years, we've had stories of what we call the gugri, or the face eater. These are described as Sasquatch-like, but with three toes and having a more mandrill or baboon-like muzzle, very similar to the devil monkey. And in the 60s, Mark Hall and Lauren Coleman, two great cryptozoologists, talked about the North American ape, or NAPES for short. These are very similar to Sasquatch, but with a divergent big toe, almost like a thumb. So with these creatures, I was like, okay, let's look into a deeper dive of these creatures and speculate on what they are. For instance, you were there at the Falk Festival. I brought up Sasquatch in the South. If they are a subspecies of Sasquatch, are they ecomorph or are they a whole other creature? My last slide was about North American apes, or what we call NAPES. They are described as more chimp-like, more, think of a giant chimp the size of a human, but it can walk on 2 feet. And this is what really this book's going into, is because I feel like these cryptids really haven't gotten the attention that they deserve the past couple years. And at least I haven't seen any books written about them, and I'm like, hey, no one's written a book. Let me be the person that does it.
Yeah. And the important thing is that you realize that people are not paying attention to research that is there, to concepts that are already there. Once again, the idea that the North American ape may be out there.
Yes, like, for instance, it's also like collection of information too. Like, a lot of times you have like this little sighting in this book, this little piece of information, this little piece of information. What I'm trying to do is collect it all into one book, into one volume. For instance, like the Gugwe. Like, there's not a lot of researchers into the Gugwe phenomenon in the first place, because this is only fairly recently that it's really been brought attention. A lot of times when people heard the word Gugwe or face eater, a lot of people thought, oh, it's just a Sasquatch, another variation. Hmm. But when you look at the morphology of this creature, it's something much different. It has a more mandrill protruding prognathic snout, very similar to like baboons and papillons. And also, supposedly, it has very long feet with three toes with claws, which is also a very, very peculiar morphology for primates, because as we know, there's no three-digit primates in our fossil record or currently. So I make some possible conclusions on this. Maybe it's a possible mutation. Also, bringing up the origins of these creatures, because as we've talked about several times, Chris, every cryptid has an origin. Yeah. These aren't just natural creatures that came out of nowhere. They have some type of natural history, more of like unnatural history for some of them, but I bring up some possible speculations on where they came from. Of course, it's speculation, of course, but it's still educated guesses, hypotheses. Not exactly theories, because we don't have the evidence yet to prove it, but they are hypotheses on where these creatures came from.
Sure.
For instance, I find correlation between the Gugwe and devil monkey. Both of them are large primates, baboon-like faces with three toes, and very violent. Literally, Gugwe means face eater. They describe it as killing and eating humans on the regular. And devil monkey, devil's literally in the name. So I'm like, okay, what if these creatures are the same creature, but convergently evolved to become one became bipedal, one stayed the same shape of like a giant baboon? So I talk about prehistoric North America and our own history of primates here in North America as well.
Well, and, especially going into things like devil monkeys, Gugwe, looking at the image of the Gugwe that's here on Cryptid Wiki, and it's, you know, I think the one thing that we tend to forget, Ryan, I mean, of course, if these stories, like we discussed quite a bit at Falk, the importance of folklore, the importance of keeping these stories alive, the importance of keeping accounts alive, because if you keep accounts alive, then people aren't afraid to give accounts whenever they see something, you know, which anomalies happen, strange things happen. But it's interesting that you are going down the path of North American apes. Chester Moore gave a great presentation on feral apes in Texas. People, I think, forget the novelty of the menagerie in Victorian times, you know, in the times of the early 1800s, things like that, where, you know, if you were a person of means to have something like, you know, a gibbon in your backyard in an enclosure, something like that was a point of high status.
Like, I believe, I'm trying to think which president, I believe either Teddy Roosevelt and Taft, they had whole menageries at the White House.
Yep.
There's stories of creatures like hippopotamus being seen on the lawn, because that's what it was seen as more aesthetic and as more exotic, having these types of pets.
Yeah.
Like, even looking to even more modern day, back in the 70s in Great Britain, they had to pass the Exotic Animals Act. Like, if you walked in London in the 60s, you might see a person walking a dog, then see a person walking a leopard. Animals, especially big cats, were seen as more exotic and something that they could have a pet as. Even here in Texas, to this modern day, there's more tigers in Texas than in India, because of how many are held by exotic owners, a lot of times illegally, and we have that phenomenon into the modern day.
Absolutely. And I mean, I have posited numerous times that the Jersey Devil may very well be a hammerhead bat. Whenever you look at the description of a hammerhead bat, whenever you look at images of it, when you start considering the fact that that bat gets 3 feet tall.
Yeah.
That's big. You see that thing in a tree. I don't care who you are. That's going to freak you out at night. And yes, it may very well have hitched its way along on a slave ship from Africa. It may have been somebody's exotic pet on a ship that it got away from. Who knows? But things like that happen regularly. You know, things like that end up aboard as strange cargo on ships without even intending to be there.
Yes.
And make their way across the ocean.
Yeah, the ideas of also invasive species, like, for instance, Chester Moore brought up, like, wild simians here in North America.
Yeah.
And also, like, look at Florida. It feels like Florida has more invasive species than indigenous species nowadays. Like, parts of Texas, we actually have living, like, populations of monkeys in South Texas because of releases and things like, and people research and things like that. Like, here in San Antonio, we have the Southwest Research Center, which has a population of baboons, and stories have gotten out in San Antonio of people seeing baboons in the woods. And then the Southwest, they talk to them, and they're like, well, we don't have any missing animals, so could these baboons be just not marked? They don't want that to get out that they got escaped, or could it be something else? That's the question we kind of have to bring in. Like, I talked to Chester Moore a lot at the Fabric Festival, and I brought up the idea of this book. And he's like, a lot of these sightings could be misidentifications of released primates, which I believe is true. Like, for instance, the North American ape, it's described as very chimp-like. A lot of these sightings could be misidentifications of released chimpanzees. Or could people seeing chimpanzees in the woods actually be seeing the North American ape? That's kind of the hard thing when there's such convergent morphologies and behaviors. What are people really seeing? Is it an indigenous primate that is somehow evolved here in North America? Or is it something that was released here recently in the past 10, 20 years?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, they're, once again, not only the menagerie concept from the Victorian era and the fact that, like, breeding pairs of animals may have escaped, that kind of stuff. But there was a huge, huge uptick in large exotic mammals for private keep in the late 60s, mid 60s, things like that. Things like chimpanzees, baboons, I mean, orangutans, that kind of stuff. And yes, much like the old joke goes, you know, with the movie Gator, where it started off with somebody getting a tiny little pet alligator for somebody for their birthday, and then it gets flushed down the toilet, and the next thing you know, it's terrorizing sewers. It sounds ridiculous, but when you get a pet chimpanzee, and at some point it becomes stronger than the largest man in your house a year or so into somewhat maturity, you may not know what to do with it. And frequently, people let those animals go.
Yeah, like people, I don't know how people forget this, but people forget that baby animals grow up to be adult animals one day.
Yeah, yeah.
A baby chimp, so cute, especially male little male chimps. But one day, that thing will be as big as you almost and have a strength of 20 men.
Yeah.
It can rip your arms off if it wanted to, rookie style. So when people want these baby animals as pets, they don't realize you have to prepare for them to grow up into adults. And many times they are very dangerous animals. There's even reports of people having like wolf dog hybrids, and it might have a little bit too much wolf that it still has those instincts and might attack people. Or a lot of times here, like I believe here in San Antonio, we have a law that if you have a wolf dog hybrid, it has to have at least 75% dog in it.
Oh, wow.
And only 25% wolf, because they know those wild instincts are still there if you have a mix of wild animal and domestic.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, here's the article I was looking for right here from the Mirror. Pet chimp owner screams he ripped her face off during harrowing phone call. Things like that. So it seems like a great idea. And I even remember we regularly talk, Ryan, about my time observing gorillas and things during abnormal psychology. And One of the stories I greatly remember from reading the work of Jane Goodall was the story of a chimp that was very much like this, brought up in a family home here in the United States, eventually got to the point where it was too big and too dangerous to be in a house, and was let go in the reserve that Jane Goodall helped build. And they found the poor thing almost throttled to death by its fellow chimps, because it only knew human sociability. It didn't know not to look other chimps in the eye, things like that. So because it knew these human sociabilities, it itself was victimized by the chimp culture once it was let go. So the idea that a socialized animal being let go into the wild can be a different situation in and of itself, even.
Yes, and to an extent it makes them even possibly even more dangerous, because if this animal is used to having humans around it, it doesn't see humans as a threat. It might use humans as a food resource, like coming up and raiding trash cans or asking for food from hikers. And then if it doesn't get what it wants, it makes it even more highly aggressive towards humans. Like, chimps in the natural world have a hierarchy. You have alpha males, then everything down below. But in it being socialized by humans, it doesn't have that ape hierarchy. So it might violently be more violent than other chimps that have been naturally born and raised in the wild.
Yeah.
So, like, released primates are very much a possible source of very, not fear, but of, like, you need to watch out for it, because these aren't going to act like any wild primate, because they're truly not. They are acting like they're raised by humans.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And, you know, the one that springs to mind immediately is that first image of a skunk ape that was taken, where the woman reported seeing an orangutan, something very orangutan-like. And when you look at the images, yes, the fur on it is very orangutan-colored. You know, there's a primate research facility right down the road in Bastrop. There's one in San Antonio as well. The fact that these things could get out regularly, let's start exploring some of the differences, Ryan, that really stand out between a traditional Sasquatch sighting, or what somebody might be believed to be a Sasquatch sighting, and a sighting of one of these.
Of course. Well, we do have a couple well-known examples within our history of cryptozoology. One of the main instances of an ape, like being, like, not being seen, but at least trace evidence, happened in Decatur, Illinois. Lauren Coleman, a cryptozoologist, found a peculiar footprint along a dry creek bed. And it appears to be like a human-like footprint, but with a divergent big toe. They went off to the side at a right angle. And I have a replica of this track. And a lot of people state, well, this might be an injury. It might be something like that. Like, it might be just a regular Sasquatch foot, but it's injured to go to the side. I've looked at the footprint, and I don't believe it is, because it shows a more morphological detail. It shows that this is a morphology, not an injury. So this saw the idea that, okay, maybe there's something else in the woods other than Sasquatch. And a good example of a possible sighting occurred actually in Oklahoma in the 70s. December 30th, 1970, the El Reno Chicken Man, they like to call it. It was a large bipedal primate being seen off the North Canadian River, which is actually a tributary to the Arkansas River. Arkansas is a tributary off the Mississippi River. You'll see there's a large congruency between the Mississippi River Delta and these apes. What was reported is a man, a farmer, said his chicken coop, the door was ripped off by the hinges. And he came out, he didn't see anything, but he saw footprints. And he described the footprints as looking more like handprints, like human handprints. And luckily, there was a piece of glass on the ground that this animal stepped on. And if you look at the footprint, it looks like a human hand with a divergent big toe. And a lot of people said, well, maybe this is a chimpanzee, something like that. This is actually taken to the local curator at the Oklahoma City Zoo, and he stated, no, this looks like an ape, but I can't identify what species. So this brought the idea of maybe this is an ape sighting, because if you see that divergent big toe, that's the real indicator that this is a possible, not a Sasquatch. The Sasquatch, of course, has five toes that are parallel. That's more of a simian-like trait, a more ape-like trait. And in my book, I bring up this possible explanation. Back in Mark A. Hall and Lauren Coleman came up with a hypothesis that these North American apes might be a surviving group of Dryopithecus. Dryopithecus, we've spoken about before, prehistoric species of ape found in Miocene Europe about 7 to 8 million years ago. But if you look at Dryopithecus, it has more correlations to Sasquatch than apes. So, in my hypothesis, I believe it's something else. I think it's an ape called Oreopithecus. If you look up Oreopithecus, this is the one and only ape that became bipedal that's not along our own human traits. Oreopithecus would never evolve to become something like Australopithecus or human. And this is also found in prehistoric Miocene Europe. And the interesting part about it is that its bipedalism is like no other ape seen before. Its foot looks like a hand. Its big toe came out at a perpendicular angle that caused its foot to act more like a tripod. The weight would be held here on the toes, the big toe, and then the heel. But with this type of bipedalism, it couldn't run bipedally or walk bipedally. It could stand up and walk a little bit, but not run. But if you move that divergent big toe distally, if you move it up the foot and put it right next to the toes, it changes the weight movement on the foot. The weight's now going towards the toes and the heel, which makes it that this animal could run bipedally. So my hypothesis, at least, is that maybe Oreopithecus didn't move to North America during prehistory and evolved to become what we now see these modern-day North American apes.
Well, and, you know, specifically, Ryan, looking at that footprint right there, that's the one from Lauren Coleman that you're talking about.
Yeah.
I have a couple of castings here. This is a casting of the Patterson-Gimlin print. It's pretty quintessential. This is pretty well what people talk about. Now, granted, I have a size 16 foot, and I'm here to tell you, my bare foot comes pretty darn close in size. But what's different, as opposed to a human, is the instep. There's very, very little instep here, which is strange. Now, when you're talking about this print from Lauren Coleman found here in America, what I find it much more close to is the Shackleton print.
Yeah.
The print of the Yeti.
Yeah.
And that, to me, looks much more akin to the print that we see here, which, you know, considering that could very well be some large mountain dwelling gorilla, something along those lines. But yeah, the print here that we're talking about is very divergent and very, very different from your average Sasquatch print.
Yes.
Right here.
And you'll actually see that in some newspaper reports back in the 1800s and early 1900s, a lot of times they would be classified as modern-day Sasquatch reports. But they're talking about footprints being found that look like human hands, or footprints being found with divergent big toes. And to me, that indicates a more of an ape-like creature, because that divergent big toe, it also appears that this creature also has a mid-tarsal break, very similar to like modern-day Sasquatch. That would allow flexibility in the foot that would allow it to be much more arboreal than Sasquatch. It would be able to climb trees. It would be able to maybe walk bipedally along branches, which is called tree clambering. We now believe that's how humans became bipedal in our own prehistory. So I believe, in my opinion, that these apes could be an offshoot of Sasquatch. maybe they are a group of apes that instead of becoming Sasquatch became more arboreal and more akin to the trees than on the ground. Because if you look at it, Sasquatch sightings very much occur the western half of the United States, a little bit in the south, of course, but primarily mountainous areas, Canada, British Columbia, Middle America, which during prehistory was very mountainous and open. Bipedalism would be very helpful for those situations.
Yeah.
The Sasquatch foot was built for mountainous terrain. You can see in the morphology of the toes, the morphology of the metatarsal break. While here in the south, the Mississippi River Delta formed about 7,000 years ago. This would have made it much more akin to Miocene Europe. Miocene Europe was wet, swampy, tropical, fruits, things like that. Mm. So if these Miocene apes moved into North America, here in the south, they would have found an environment very similar to their own homeland. This possibly would have made it, they would have to evolve to become bipedal. And as large as Sasquatch, they would find an environment that they could evolve to become what we now know as apes. Because if you look at ape sightings, a lot of them occur along the Mississippi River Delta and its tributaries. Mississippi River Delta, Mississippi, Arkansas River, Red River, all these little tributaries off of it, even the Allegheny River. So while these animals found an environment similar to mice in Europe and evolved to become a little bit more bipedal to hide away from, of course, large predators like you had Smilodon, Xenosmilus, and short-faced bear here in the south, well, if they became more hominoid-like, but didn't go all the way, they're more arboreal to make sure they don't compete with Sasquatch. So, in my own opinion, I bring it up, especially at the end of the book, that competition between these animals would be very much a factor in it. That's something that people don't realize with cryptids. Like when people bring up seeing Dogman and Bigfoot and black cats on their property. Does make sense. These animals would compete each other to extinction. Hmm. So what if these apes became arboreal up in the trees but not compete with Sasquatch and not compete with other large mammalian animals here in North America that are terrestrial? Maybe it's a more arboreal creature up in the trees to not compete with them. Maybe it can walk bipedally at times. Like some people have even speculated that maybe the falcon monster itself is an ape. Which, in my opinion, I don't believe it is. I believe it's a Sasquatch.
Yeah.
But maybe it can walk bipedally for short amounts of time to get from, like, area of tree to area of tree. That's what we believe that humans became bipedal. Why couldn't this also be occurring here in North America?
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. It is the foregone conclusion of actual evolution that we went from ape similar to chimpanzee, and there was a change somewhere, and that, you know, we began walking bipedally, all that kind of stuff. So the fact that same morphology would continue here, and especially the fact that they would divergently evolve so that they did not compete with each other,
yes,
makes a lot of sense, Ryan.
Yes, and that's the one thing that I think it's kind of almost lacking within cryptozoology, which I can understand, but it's like the ideas of like the evolutionary tracks of cryptids and how they interact with other natural species. Like how would Sasquatch interact with bears, and how would they convergently evolve away from these animals and not compete with each other? Something called niche differentiation, which is when animals have the same niche, but they migrate away from each other. So they don't, like, for instance, one season deer might be in the same area, then the next season a different species of deer. So they don't compete with each other. Maybe the same thing occurred with these primates. Because also to bring up the devil monkey, in my own opinion, I believe the devil monkey is a primate that evolved here in North America. Because not a lot of people realize it, that primates have a natural history here in North America. Some of the first primates actually evolved in North America during the Eocene.
Yeah.
About 50 million years ago, some of the first, like, what we call pro-simians, like modern-day II, like they look like modern-day II's and bush babies, were indigenous to North America.
Yeah.
So what if there's a what we call a ghost lineage of primates that were indigenous to North America that evolved into what we now know as devil monkeys? And if you look at the devil monkey, it's very convergently evolved to what we call papianins, which are like therapificus, baboons, chacmas, things like that.
Yep.
So those primates, we have to look at the actual known fossil record. We have to look at the actual known, like, natural world. Those primates are large-bodied, live in large grasslands, and live alongside large megafauna. What was found in prehistoric North America? Large grasslands, megafaunal species like mammoths, saber-toothed cats, short-faced bears, equids. So if you look at the devil monkey, it fits very well to North America during prehistory. It would have been like our own version of baboons. Even if you look at the size of devil monkeys, this guy is being very large. A little bit smaller than a human, but like the size of like a large dog. Larger than modern-day baboons. But then if you look at Africa's prehistory, look up Dinopithecus. Dinopithecus was a giant baboon the size of a human.
Yeah.
That we believed hunted our own ancestors, Australopithecines. So if you move to Dinopithecus in North America, it looks almost exactly like our modern-day devil monkey. I don't think it is Dinopithecus, but I believe it's a primate that evolved here in North America that convergently evolved to become very baboon-like because of a similar environment here in North America during prehistory. Then you have to bring in the question, okay, if there's a primate that evolved here in North America, what about Sasquatch and Napes? These creatures, if they moved into North America, they would have found an environment that would have already had a primate in it. Maybe that's the reason why Bigfoot became bipedal to not compete with modern-day devil monkeys. Maybe the Napes and devil monkeys, if you look at the sightings, they're in very different areas.
Yeah.
And they happen at different times of the year. That is literally an example of possible niche differentiation. Maybe these animals are both arboreal and don't compete with each other, so they migrate out of certain areas at certain times of the year. Or even, if you look at it, Nape sightings are a lot less common than devil monkey sightings. Maybe the Nape is very much a more of a bear, very rare animal, than the devil monkey is more like a wolf. They hunt, they look like they move in packs. They're very much canine-like. Hmm. They're not. A lot of people believe these devil monkeys might be misidentifications of Dogman. I don't personally believe that. I believe they have more simian traits. But maybe they act more like wolves that move in packs, while the Nape is more like a grizzly bear. It's one single animal, moves in large areas. Yeah. So you see kind of this correlation between known species and these unrecognized species.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, once again, the devil monkey, once you start looking at it, very, very baboon-esque in the description of it. And yeah, baboons move in troops. They move in groupings. They aren't really a solitary animal. Most of those sightings are happening up along the western coast of the United States. So the idea of them moving up from Mexico or something like that, or moving up from down there, not crazy.
Yeah. Like, for instance, we've had a lot of sightings here in Texas. At Lake Texoma, back in the early 2000s, people out there camping heard hooting and hollering in the woods, and they described four or five giant monkeys coming out of the woods that looked like giant baboons. And of course, if you looked in the area, there could be escaped baboons in the area, but they describe these creatures as much larger and actually running on their hind legs at them. And then along the Appalachian Trail, the Appalachian Mountains, there's been a long tradition of people seeing these monkeys in the woods. And these monkeys have much longer feet than actual, like, baboons. And some have even speculated that maybe they might be what we call like the escaped or phantom kangaroo phenomena.
Mm.
In the Midwest, people report seeing kangaroo-like animals. Maybe it might be these actual devil monkeys that are being seen. Because one big thing that's peculiar about devil monkey sightings is that they're reported again having three toes and very much a long foot and three toes. And if you look at the the morphology that would make sense, because that three-toe footprint would make it that they would be more agile runners. Maybe if they hunt prey, they would chase down their prey. Maybe they would use a troop to maybe correlate with each other and hunt down prey like that. Which, in my opinion, getting hunted down by a bunch of giant baboons the size of humans is a terrifying idea to think about.
Yes. Yeah, getting hunted down by one baboon is a terrifying thing to think about, much less a troop of them. And, you know, it's fascinating to think about that. How long have sightings like this been reported, Ryan? How far back do these sightings go? I mean, I know sightings of Sasquatch, stories of Sasquatch, things like that go back to before the time of frontiersmen, all that kind of good stuff, especially with native tribes. But what about these sightings? What about the sightings of Napes, that kind of stuff? How far back do those go?
Well, Nape sightings possibly go back to the 1800s because reports of gorillas in the woods or people seeing chimpanzees. Like, a lot of times people speculate this might be Sasquatch, but a lot of times when you look at the descriptions, they're describing something else. And when it comes to, like, the devil monkey, this might be an ancient species because there's stories up in Alaska of the tailed ones. The people describe giant monkeys in the woods. If you watched the show Missing in Alaska, I believe, who had our friend Ken Gerhard on it, they talked about monkeys being seen in Alaska. And here in the South, some of the native tribes talked about tailed creatures living in the woods that look like humans. And a possible example of Napes being referenced by indigenous cultures happened in Illinois. There's a place called Footprint Rock. It's in southern Illinois and has a bunch of human footprints on it. These are petroglyphs carved maybe a couple thousand years ago, but there's a couple footprints with a divergent big toe, like what we see in Nape footprints. And it's interesting because this rock, these petroglyphs, only about 150 miles away from Desiter, Illinois, where the Nape footprint was found back in the 60s. So maybe these Napes lived and still persist in the area and lived there for a couple thousand years, and the indigenous cultures referenced them, like how indigenous cultures reference Sasquatch and other cryptids being seen in the modern day, like Thunderbirds. Maybe this cryptid was kind of always hiding under our nose and we never even realized it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's just it. And to realize that I say it pretty regularly on the show, Ryan. We have explored very little of the United States. I'll bring it up. I'll bring up the image of the United States at night from the ISS, and this is just one of the last few that's been taken, folks. But when you look at the United States, There's a whole lot of black. There's a whole lot of nothing in some places. It's kind of like saying, Ryan, that we have explored 90% of the ocean. You know, I don't think we have.
Yeah,
we have not. We have discovered probably a good 50-60% of the animals on at least terrestrial Earth. Who knows how many we're missing in the ocean and deep ocean and fresh waters, things like that. Because, I mean, even lakes like Loch Ness go down into the 100 plus meters in depth. You know, so I think we have a lot of unexplored territory, a lot of territory that would make perfect habitat for things like primates.
Yes, and like, the thing is, like, what these unexplored areas, we have to have those people that want to explore the areas. Like, in order to get to the answer, you have to ask a question in the first place. And that's something that I'm really big on with my research, is asking those questions. There's a quote I always like to tell people: don't be afraid of the unknown. Only through discovering it will the unknown ever be known. only through discovery, only through science and asking questions will we ever get to the answers of the natural world. Too many times we believe that we know everything. How many times have you heard people say, oh, we've already discovered all the animals on Earth? Well, not necessarily. In the 1800s, they believed they discovered all the animals on Earth, but we've discovered several primate species since then. Yeah. So who says the modern day is any different from the past? Like, everyone believes at the current time that they're living in, they have the top technology. People yeah. back in the early 1900s thought they had the top technology, which they did at the time, but it evolves, it changes. So does knowledge and science. Like, if you get stuck in dogma, if you get stuck in having the same ideas, you will never get out of that. And you'll only be with the current knowledge. You'll never get new ideas and make new discoveries.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, and Falk, you brought up a fantastic point that I have been using over and over again. And that is the timeline of discovery. The timeline of discovery from the point of a culture hearing about an animal. And the example that you gave was gorilla. You know, the fact that we heard about this thing, but we didn't actually actively discover it. The cultures over there knew about it. They talked about it. Once we heard about it, it took us 70 years to actively find the animal. Even with localized people, all that kind of stuff, took science 70 years to show that that animal actively existed. And while, yes, stories of Sasquatch, other creatures such as Sasquatch, have been in local lore and native lore and native story for hundreds and hundreds of years, to Anglos and to the West, we have only discovered them in the last 60. Yeah. So on that 100-year timeline of discovery, we've still got quite a few years left to go before yeah. we actively come across the animal or prove its existence.
You also have to have the people that want to go out and make the discovery in the first place. Yeah. Like, we have the modern-day big Sasquatch researchers. But back in the day, let's say 1960s or 50s, you only had a couple people that were into it. You had the big four, like John Green and Rene de Hinden and Grover Krantz. We, of course, have a lot more people nowadays that want to research it. But like what you always bring up, me being the next generation. If after this generation of researchers, if no one wants to go out looking for these creatures, of course we'll never find them. Like, yeah. A Sasquatch is not going to come up to your front door and say, hey, I'm here. You have to go where they are. You have to do the research yourself.
Yeah.
But you have to bring in the next generation because you have to have those different ideas, different viewpoints. Like, even I've seen it even occur myself. Modern day cryptozoology is much more akin to more paranormal research than how it used to be.
Hmm.
Back in early cryptozoology, it's very much flesh and blood. Look at people like Bernard Hoovermans. They looked a lot at the fossil record, looked at modern species, looked at things like that. While yeah. nowadays with cryptozoology, a lot of people bring in metaphysics, paranormal, UFOs, and all this stuff.
Yeah.
They're getting away from the science of it and getting more closely to speculative and the more fantastical side of it.
Well, more into the crypto, less into the zoology.
Yes. Like, it's a lot of times I like to call it paracryptozoology. Mm. The ideas are like, people like to always came up to me and they ask, is it Wendigo and Skinwalkers, are those cryptids? I'm like, they are not. Those are something else.
Yeah.
Those are what we call paracryptids,
yeah.
more paranormal creatures. While cryptozoology is purely, in my opinion, flesh and blood, unknown species.
Yes.
But the ideas of, like, with Sasquatch, the aper, people like to call people like me, the aper is kind of dying out. The only real researchers I can think of is, like, myself, Cliff Berkman, Ken Gerhard, Lauren Coleman, Jeff Meldrum. But the ideas are more paranormal, more psych ops is bringing in more of the more crypto, not really the zoology.
Well, and, you know, let's explore that because we've got you for about another 10 minutes. And, you know, what one of the things that I that I am all about on this show is demystification. And because unless you demystify something, you can't really dive into it. You're going to be diving into it with a lean one way or the other until it's demystified for you. You know, you're either going to be going in as a believer or a non-believer. And there's a problem with that when you're trying to examine a set of data. When you're trying to look at points of datum in a data set, you need to be as dispassionate as possible. And yeah. that's kind of what I was telling the gentleman in the post, about the foot that I was telling you about and the footprint, where he's like, oh, well, you know, orangutans don't have a foot this size. And it's like, well, number one, you gave zero reference to size. Like the image that you took was, it was an image of a footprint in mud, but it wasn't really scientifically done. The data wasn't really gathered. Because, I mean, evidence is what you hand your lawyer to exonerate you. That's evidence, yes. You know, and that will be my challenge to anybody always, is so you say you have evidence. Would it exonerate you in court? Would you have enough faith in that evidence to hand it over and go, here it is, right here. This is the piece of evidence, Ryan. This will exonerate us and keep us free. Because unless it's on that level, like there's an issue there, you know, and that goes beyond belief. That goes beyond faith. That goes into statistic. That goes into science. That goes into how the data was gathered in the field, all yeah. that kind of stuff. So, it's hard to say, hey, look, I have an evidence of a really large Sasquatch foot and it's 16 inches. I guess I have to believe you that it's 16 inches because you don't have a ruler there next to it.
Yeah. Like, it's the idea of also of belief versus science.
Yes.
Like, a lot of times I've seen with researchers, they go into research already having their own belief set. Already yes. having, like, well, if I go into this area, there's going to be Sasquatch. If I go to this person, they already saw a Bigfoot, I'm going to get everything I can to prove that. Technically, in my opinion, if you're going to go talk to someone that's either Dog Man or something, the last option should be Dog Man. Because, like, your last option, you should go through all the logical settings, Occam's Razor.
Yeah.
The simplest answer usually is the right answer. And if you go into situations already believing in something, it's going to change your own perspective.
Exactly.
I say this all the time. If you have a preperceived notion of belief,
yeah.
you're going to expect to see that in your own reality. It's like some people like Bigfoot on the brain. It's very much a thing.
Yes, it is.
If you go in the woods and you're researching Bigfoot, every other sound you're going to hear is going to be a Bigfoot. If you go into a haunted house and you expect to see a ghost, every little piece of dust is going to be an orb. Yeah. If you're researching UFOs and you expect to see a UFO, that star in the sky is moving. Oh, it's a UFO, but it's not actually moving. You have a pre-belief of notion of, like, reality. It alters your own reality.
Yeah.
It's like people that are, for instance, highly religious. They might see Jesus' face in a corn chip. Like, that's because your own psychology
yeah.
is creating your own perception, because perception is not reality. Perception is coming from your own belief set, your own psychology, and your own reality.
That's right. That's right. You know, and it's the fact of, I say it on the show regularly, if you're out there, you're doing paranormal investigation, you're doing Bigfoot investigation, what have you, whenever you're prepping your gear, think about something else. Think about your favorite comedy show, whatever. Don't think about where you're going, what you've heard, the stories you've heard about the place, anything like that. I have recommended for years, Ryan, that if you're doing this kind of investigation and you get stories from people before you go out, whoever interviews them should not be on the hunt.
Yeah.
Shouldn't be there. You gathered the story. You are now looking at all points of data from a skewed point of view. The people going out there should be going out with zero idea of what they're investigating, just going out to gather evidence, to gather data, nothing more. Nothing more. Yeah. They shouldn't hear the story of what happened in the place, because then they're looking at it through that lens scientifically as well. And you're no longer scientifically evaluating the evidence.
They're trying to support their own answers. Like, if you go into an area and you've heard that there's a lot of Bigfoot sightings and things like that, you're going to be looking for that evidence. While the evidence might not actually be there. Like, for instance, I've brought up before the tree structure phenomena. Mm. Like, people that go into Bigfoot areas, they see a tree structure, like a broken trick, a broken like branch or something. Oh, a Sasquatch did that. But if you saw that down by your house, are you going to say a Sasquatch did that in the middle of a city? Not necessarily.
Yeah.
So if you have the evidence versus data, you want to collect data, not evidence, because that data together will lead to the evidence of proof of existence.
Exactly.
But without that data not being skewed, how can we ever get to the evidence and proof? Like, a lot of people forget the scientific method. You don't create the hypothesis until after you get the evidence. You don't say, oh, it's Bigfoot, before you go out into the field. You say, it could be anything. Let's go find evidence.
That's right.
And then we'll see what the evidence says afterwards.
Yeah.
A lot of people go out there with only hypothesis in mind, and that's the opposite of the scientific method. That's putting it on its head. It should be, let's go out there, see what evidence we find. But data,
form a hypothesis, and then through experiment of the hypothesis, and through experimentation based on said hypothesis, we will find a theory.
Yeah. Like, for instance, like wood knocking. Okay. If I knock on this tree 3 times, I get a wood knock back. Okay. Let's see if we can do that 3 different times. Okay, cool. That's data. That's an experiment we just experimented with and we got evidence back. Cool. Let's see if we can keep doing this over and over again.
That's right.
Like people that have habituation sites with Sasquatch. Okay. If you keep having Sasquatch sightings in the same area, let's go at different times of the year. See if we can experiment, see if there's any type of correlating evidence for data sets, and go from there.
Yeah.
But not a lot of people want to put in that more scientific viewpoint because it becomes more fantastical. It becomes more, let's go in the woods hunting a monster. No, that's not what this is. This is science. How can we get to the science of this?
And, you know, sadly, Ryan, sadly, the reason why you don't hear the evening news tell you on the way out the door, like, oh, yeah, by the way, everybody, CERN created matter from light. As exciting as it sounds, it is unsexy. Science is not sexy to the average person, you know?
Yeah.
And unfortunately, there are many shows out there that use quite a bit of science and stuff like that. And it's fantastic. They don't move fast, you know?
Yeah.
Fortunately, many programs have brought many topics like cryptozoology, things like that, to a much larger audience. Fortunately. Yeah. Because that increases people like you who are actively exploring this with the zoology after the crypto, you know, and the idea that, you know, if enough people talked about this thing, it may actively exist. Let's look at the facts. Let's look at the biology. Let's look at the morphology and see if it's a possibility, you know. So it's fantastic and it's great. But at the same time, there is an onus upon us, all of us, researchers, hosts, everything to, man, make sure you're adding salt to the recipe, folks, you know, and and teaspoons of it. You know. Because we need to be looking at data. We need to be looking at things in terms of data, and get back to the science of it, get back to the zoology of it. So thank you for everything that you do in that world, Ryan, and for the fact that your new stuff is all about that. Your first book was very much cryptids of the world, different crypto stories, cryptids from around the globe, but Sasquatch, a prehistory, and your new book, which will be released hopefully early summer,
hopefully,
are all science. So it's fantastic.
Yeah, I try to bring a perspective into this field that might be lacking. Like, cryptozoology truly is, it's fantastical. It's amazing. It's romanticized. But cryptozoology is a marriage of the logical and the illogical, science and superstition.
Yeah.
So how can we get to the answer with a mix of both and not lose ourselves in the fantastical?
Yeah, absolutely. Ryan, such a level head on your shoulders, my friend. Before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to keep up with your work, where they can go to follow you on social media, all that kind of good stuff, bud.
Of course. Well, on my social medias, if you want to look up Ryan Edwards on Facebook, I'll be there. If you look up R. Edwards on my Instagram, I also keep up on there. If you're interested in getting the books, look up on Amazon. Look up Cryptids of the World by Ryan Edwards. Sasquatch, a Prehistory of a Living Legend by Ryan Edwards as well. That'll also be available on Eerie Lights Publishing. That's a publishing company by David Wetterly, another great cryptozoologist in this world. He published the second book, and hopefully we'll be publishing my third book as well. That one hopefully will be available next, hopefully later this year. I'm just getting the publishing processing started right now. But as soon as that title becomes available to the public, I will let Chris Jordan know, or Chris Realm, and we'll let you guys know.
Absolutely, man. Thank you so much, as always, Ryan. Greatly appreciate you coming on the show, talking about your amazing research into these topics. So, greatly. And also, you have the strange series going on. We have the Symposium of the Strange coming up. And, yes. That's a whole series that you and King Gerhardt, I'm working with it with you guys a little bit. So tell them a little bit about Symposium of the Strange real quick before we let you go.
Cool. Symposium of the Strange. It's going to be a new kind of a mini author event, mini conference starting here in San Antonio. It's going to be based out of the Mad Time Machine and Mineshaft Saloon restaurant here in San Antonio. I work there, so it's a great place. And it's going to be hopefully a monthly event. The first one's going to be putting on this July 31st. Put that on your calendars, guys. It's going to be the first event's going to be Bigfoot in Texas. We have three presenters. We have myself, Ken Gerhardt, and my friend Rob Nichols. Rob Nichols, he is Bear County Bigfoot. He does a lot of Sasquatch reports here in Texas, especially San Antonio. And we're going to try to do this as a monthly event, bring in different researchers, different perspectives. It could be from paranormal to cryptozoology, ufology, demonology, anything like that. We're trying to bring in different researchers, different authors, things like that. And hopefully, if this does get set off, we're going to try to bring in as many people as we can. We're going to be selling tickets for the event. And currently, right now, we're in the middle of making the event bright for it. As soon as we have more information for you guys, we will have on Chaos Realm over here. Chaos Realm is going to be helping present this. Chris, he's been doing a lot of work for this, so we really appreciate his help. And everyone else that's helping with this, Rob Nichols, Kate Gerhard, myself, I'm doing a little bit of it. So hopefully you guys are interested in this, and we'll see us there on July 31st.
Absolutely. I can't wait. It's going to be super fun, man. Thank you as always. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience. While you are online checking out everything from Ryan Edwards, folks, make sure to stop on by curiousrealm.com/store. That is where you can find all the books from our guests, including Ryan Edwards. You can also stop by curiousrealm.com/video. That is where you can follow all of the YouTube channels of our guests as well. Don't forget, if you are a Roku user, we now have a Curious Realm Roku app out there, which has all of the videos as well as tons of binaural beat therapy music by yours truly. So stop on by and download that if you are a Roku user. Thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in every week. Thank you so much for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what makes the conversation, and without the conversation, the world does not move forward. So here's to humanity, everybody. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm.
Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, as well as KPNL Radio, APR TV, and the Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media and Aftermath Media family of podcasts. For more great shows and members-only content, visit groundzeromedia.org and aftermathmedia.com today. Thanks for listening, stay curious, and remember, the other side is always watching.